Shrink Wrap Radio number 434, The Science and Pseudoscience of Psychology, with Dr. Scott Lilienfeld.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Scott Lilienfeld, who is the Samuel Candler Dobbs Professor of Psychology at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, and editor of the 2014 book, Science and Pseudoscience in Clinical Psychology, 2nd edition. For more information about Dr. Lilienfeld's background, please consult our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Scott Lilienfeld, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm really happy to have you on the show to discuss the impact of science and pseudoscience on psychology in general and clinical psychology in particular. Perhaps a good place for us to start would be to have you give us your definition of science and pseudoscience and how one can distinguish between the two.
Well, it's a tough question. It's a good one. It's one I think the field struggles with, and I should say before I dive in too much into it that there's, I think, a lot of dispute even among philosophers of science about what science is and what pseudoscience is. So I'll give you my own view.
Okay.
My own take is that the difference between science and pseudoscience is probably more one of degree than of kind. I think there's often a kind of murky middle ground between science and pseudoscience. Because certainly there are lots of scientists who do pseudoscientific things, and there are lots of pseudoscientific researchers and therapists who will often behave, think, and act scientifically. But to me, there is still a difference, even though it's more one of degree than kind. To me, the fundamental difference, if there's one, is that science is a relentless attempt to try to compensate and control for confirmation bias, which is a bias that all of us, myself included, are prone to. Confirmation bias being a tendency to seek out information that's consistent with what we believe and sometimes want to believe, and deny, dismiss, or distort information that's inconsistent with that belief. Again, it's a bias we're all prone to. And to me, if you look at the history of science, it is a continual effort and a never a totally successful effort, because science being created by and performed by human beings is inherently fallible, but it's an effort to try to find ways of compensating for, controlling for confirmation bias in a way that makes us more likely to avoid mistakes, hopefully more likely to find out the truth. In pseudosciences, I think you're more likely to see a failure in many cases to control for confirmation bias, to implement the safeguards of science. So, for example, in psychology and psychotherapy, we use things like randomized controlled trials or systematic within subject designs to try to minimize error, particularly confirmation bias. In pseudosciences, I think we're somewhat less likely to see those kinds of safeguards. And to me, that's the fundamental difference. I think there are also several warning signs to look out for that may alert us to the fact that something might be pseudoscientific. So, for example, if the proponents of a discipline often do not self-correct after mistakes, that is, if they keep making the same claims despite errors, if they make extraordinary claims that go way beyond the existing evidence, that's also a sign. If they do not emphasize replicability of results, that may be an indication. If they rely more on anecdotes or testimonials than on systematic sources of evidence, that's an important sign. If the claims are difficult to disprove, difficult to falsify, that is, if they would be consistent with any potential source of evidence, that's also something to look for. So I see all of those as potential warning signs to keep in mind when one is evaluating whether or not a claim is something that's plausible or potentially scientific, or whether it's pseudoscientific and therefore rather less plausible.
Well, I'm glad to hear you acknowledge that that is kind of continuum, and that there is sort of a gray, murky area in the middle, because I agree with you, and if you took a black and white position, I was prepared to kind of test your religion a bit on that.
And yeah, I think that's right. I think there are relatively few things in this world, or some, but there are relatively few things that are black and white. I think, though, one doesn't want to make the opposite mistake, I think, which sometimes I see too, which is for people to say, because there's no black and white difference, therefore, it's not worth making a distinction. As S.S. Stevens, the famous psychophysicist, pointed out, there's probably no clear demarcation point between day and night, but that doesn't mean that we can't usually tell the difference 90% of the time, whether it's day or night.
Yeah, that's a good metaphor. And in regard to the confirmation bias, when I was in graduate school, or maybe undergraduate, psychology, you know, a big deal was made about how scientists test a hypothesis, and if it's disconfirmed, then they let go of it and they move on to something else. But it seems to me that in practice, that's often not how scientists behave, that they have some kind of an intuition or idea, you know, based upon their study of the field and their years of experience, and they have this inner conviction of, by God, this is how it is, and they just keep researching and researching and researching instead of letting go of the hypothesis or letting go of the larger idea. They cling to it, and, you know, until they find a way to demonstrate it, or else they don't.
That's right. I agree with more or less what you said. I think that that's what's sometimes called a strong inference model of science. You do one study, and if the findings don't come out the way you want them to or expect them to, then you drop it and move on to a different model. That's right. That's the way some people see science. I think you're right that in practice, one almost never sees that. And many people, myself included, would argue that I'm not sure we should operate that way in science, because after all, especially in fields like psychology, there often are multiple interpretations for negative findings, right? So negative findings could mean your core theory is wrong, but it could mean maybe you didn't measure things correctly, or maybe your sample size wasn't quite right, or maybe your participants misunderstood the instructions, or in a psychotherapy study, maybe the therapy wasn't delivered ideally, and so on and so forth. So if a theory has what is sometimes colloquially called a lot of money in the bank, if it has a good track record of previously corroborated findings, if it's done pretty well in the past, it might actually be a bad idea to suddenly drop it after one result, because after all, some of scientists' intuitions about their theory may in part be based on a previous track record of good results. They've been using a therapy for a long time and doing studies on that therapy and had very good results in previous controlled trials, and then there's one negative finding after 20 successful findings, there might be a good reason to say, well, you know, maybe we should take another look at this before we move on to something else. I think that the tougher issue, which I think you raise, is when do you move on? When do you drop a existing theory? I don't think there's any clear guidance to that question. I'm not sure there is a simple answer. I do think, though, that what we can say is that confirmation bias might be somewhat useful in the very early stages of scientific investigation. Maybe when you're trying to see whether or not you might be right, it might be good to be a little persistent and dogged and say, well, you know, I've had one or two failures, but I'm going to keep trying. But there comes a point where the evidence becomes so overwhelming that you have to begin to at least question yourself and ask, am I perhaps wrong about this?
Yes.
I think that's part of what the scientific attitude is about. I think it's one thing to say, you know, the data are not supporting my theory and be open about it, but you know what, I'm going to keep investigating this anyway, even though I don't think there's great evidence for my theory. That's okay. I mean, that's a choice scientists sometimes make, and it may not always be a bad choice. What I don't think is permissible, and then there's a Hungarian philosopher of science, Imre Lakatos, who wrote about this, what's not permissible is to say, you know what, I'm not going to even take a look at these negative results. I'm going to pretend as though my theory or my model of therapy is in great shape when it's not. That, I think, is not permissible. It is permissible to say my theory isn't in great shape, it's not working out very well, but I'm going to keep investigating it because I have a conviction or an intuition that there's something to it after all. That's okay, and there have been cases in science where that kind of thing has panned out.
Okay. Well, I was looking through the books on Amazon.com that you've written, edited, or co-authored, and I see the following titles: Science and Pseudoscience and Clinical Psychology, and you just recently brought out the second edition of that with lots of, that was an edited volume with lots of contributors. And then you've got one called 50 Great Myths of Popular Psychology, Shattering Widespread Misconceptions About Human Behavior. And that looks like a fun one. And then you've got Brainwashed, The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience, which is, I think, very current and contemporary and something that we'll talk about a little bit. Mm-hmm. You seem to be on something of a crusade about the evils of pseudoscience, particularly in relation to psychology. Is there a story, perhaps, about what got you started in this direction?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I would, at the risk of a little bit of self-promotion, if that's okay, I'm also proud of a book that we did. Actually, one of the ones I'm most proud about is one that actually focuses on the positive side of psychology. So we also wrote a book called The Great Ideas of Clinical Science. I co-edited that with my friend Bill Adani's 17 Principles That Every Mental Health Professional Should Understand. So we felt very strongly that it's important not just to dispel ideas that aren't very good or debunk, but also to say what is good and what is well established. So,
oh, good.
So we've done a bit of both, and we have another book called Great Readings in Clinical Science where we do the same thing. But you're right. I think we certainly in our work and that with my colleagues, we've certainly tried to focus quite a bit on reducing error. I think that one of my own feelings about this is that as a field in psychology, we have sometimes not focused enough on being self-critical, and I have to say, I think I probably was in that same boat myself when I first started the field, and I'm a pretty strong believer that at the heart of science is a relentless self-criticism, and some of that means criticizing other people, which sometimes means stepping on people's toes. It also means taking a good hard look at the claims you've made and then the research you've done and being willing to admit that you might be wrong about something.
Was there something that sensitized you to this issue?
I'm sorry, David?
Was there something that sensitized you to this issue? Something that
There? I would not. So I thought about that a bit. I would not say there was one specific event that sensitized me. I think what probably sensitized me over the long haul is that before I got into psychology, I think I had a bit more of an interest in science in general and maybe more the natural sciences. So my first love was actually astronomy, and I also was very much loving paleontology and was also initially thinking of going to medical school and loved zoology and biology and so on. And when I got into psychology, I really fell very much in love with it. I think it's, as I tell my students, still a love affair. I've never gotten over it. I still love psychology. I'm very glad I went into it, but I think I became somewhat disenchanted in my undergraduate years and in my beginning graduate years, too. In the status of the field, I was somewhat surprised, in some cases somewhat dismayed by what I saw was a tendency for a field to latch on to lots of fads and get very enthusiastic prematurely about certain claims before the evidence was in.
Yeah.
And I think what also swayed me quite a bit even more was in the 1990s, which I think coincided with a lot of my interest in this topic, were the recovered memory wars, where I saw a lot of therapists behaving in ways that I found very troubling, both scientifically and ethically, and became pretty familiar with a lot of these cases and met a few of the individuals involved and was, again, disturbed and saddened. And I was saddened by what I saw in terms of the personal impact on individuals and also saddened me as a field because I felt that that was a period of time when our field was not sufficiently self-critical and when critics voiced concerns, rather than trying to address those concerns, I saw a number of people circling the wagons and try to defend our field against criticism from the outside. So all of those things, I think, conspired to make me interested in the topic, and also make me convinced that healthy criticism is actually the sign of a good field, that fields that are in good shape scientifically and ethically are secure enough to take the criticism. Fields that are not, I think, often tend to circle the wagons and react negatively and somewhat defensively to external criticism. And I think, unfortunately, clinical psychology is sometimes still a little bit stuck in that mode.
Okay. Now, the foreword to your book suggests that there's been a long history of people embracing pseudoscience, and a number of examples were given going way back in time. Perhaps you can hit some of the high points of that history, or maybe I should say low points here.
Yeah, sure, exactly, right. So the foreword was written by my friend Carol Tavris, who's actually a social psychologist, and yes, there's been a long history in psychology and psychiatry of false beliefs, many of which have been quite harmful, of course. So, and it's not just psychology that is subject to this. Some would argue in psychiatry it's just as bad, if not worse. I mean, if you look at the history of what was tried in psychiatry, other areas of medicine in the past, of course, things like bloodletting, which probably killed our first president, George Washington, and leaching and blistering and all other kinds of things, spinning people around in chairs and putting people on tranquilizing chairs. These were thought to be fairly effective treatments for psychological maladies, and bloodletting, of course, for some physical maladies as well. Prefrontal lobotomy, of course, was one of the worst mental health fiascos of the 20th century. But people forget that the prefrontal lobotomy earned Egas Moniz, the Portuguese neurosurgeon who really was the major person who introduced it to humans, the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1949 for developing prefrontal lobotomy. So these were beliefs that were widely held by lots of smart, very well-educated people. They were wrong, and they did great harm. And I think it's important for students to be able to look back at these beliefs, because it could very well be that certain things we're doing today, some people have argued that's true with certain medications. I don't know whether that's true, but some people made the argument. May be in 50, 100 years, look back in much the same way, and we may ask ourselves, what were we doing? What were we thinking? And the temptation, I think, is to look back at some of these practices and giggle or laugh or say how silly these people were. But we have to remember that they were just as smart as we are. And the difference, though, is that they did not, at that point, have as much, A, background knowledge, or B, knowledge about scientific methodology to help them rule out alternative explanations.
Okay. Again, in the foreword to the book, there's a list of a number of widely held beliefs promoted by many psychotherapists that have been discredited by empirical evidence. And some of the ones mentioned in the foreword are that subliminal messages influence behavior. Mm-hmm. I think I might still believe that from the original Vance Packard book.
And admittedly, in fairness, there is some controversy about whether subliminal messages might influence very short-term behaviors like thirst or hunger or things like that. Mm-hmm. A bit of a mixed literature. What I think does seem to be pretty clear is that subliminal messages can't make one, for example, decide to buy a product in the long term that one wasn't intending to buy, or change one's political beliefs about a candidate or things like that. It's pretty clear. If there are effects, they seem to be very slight, and they're probably very short term if they exist at all.
Yeah, that's really fascinating, and somehow that message hasn't made it out into the world at large.
It sure hasn't, no.
which is part of your quest. And they're already also mentioned here, children who masturbate or play doctor have probably been sexually molested.
And there's a broader worry about that, of course. There are people looking for signs or indicators of sexual abuse, sexual molestation that may not always be very well supported empirically. And that's, of course, a kind of belief that can do great harm.
Yeah. Another one here is, if left unexpressed, anger builds up like steam in a teapot until it explodes in verbal or physical aggression.
Yeah, that's sort of the, you know, comes very much out of the Freudian model, right?
That sure.
Anger is a bit like a, it's sort of that way. It builds up and we have to release it or else it's going to, we're going to explode. And I just don't think anger works quite that way. In fact, if anything, most of the literature suggests that expressing anger fuels the flames of anger rather than reduces them, probably because for most of us, myself included, when you get angry, you get angry about the fact that you're angry. So we humans are thinking organisms, so we react to our previous thoughts. So anger is an aversive emotion, so when you get angry, it's not fun to be angry. So that in turn makes you angry because you got angry, and then in turn you get angry about that and so on. So it just kind of builds on itself.
Yeah.
So in most cases, it's not to say, and again, there's, I think, a kernel of truth in this misconception. It's not as though if you're angry, you should just let it simmer. You want to deal with it, of course, but the best way of dealing with it is by being assertive, as we know. And here's an area where the psychotherapists, I think, have been enormously helpful in terms of assertiveness training and so on. Albert Ellis did a lot of wonderful writing on this, too, is appropriately address the source of the anger. And that's a good, healthy way of getting the anger out and also addressing the actual origins of the anger rather than just hitting a pillow or, you know, yelling at your dog or something like that.
Yeah. Another clinically relevant one listed here is projective tests like the Rorschach validly diagnose personality disorders, most forms of psychopathology, and sexual abuse.
Yeah, well, I made some enemies. Carol Tavris wrote the foreword, but I would agree with Carol on that one. I made some enemies by saying that, but I think the Rorschach ink blot test is useful for a couple of purposes, but I think it is another example of where we've often made claims that go beyond the data. Now, again, sometimes, in fairness, there are some psychologists who've made the opposite mistake and said the Rorschach is useless, it's not valid for anything, and that's not right either. I think the Rorschach is okay. It's not great, but I think it's okay for detecting thought disorder and thinking disturbances that we might see in schizophrenia and sometimes in bipolar disorder. But I think for detecting personality traits like impulsivity or anxiety or oppositionalism or disorders like psychopathy, psychopathic personality or depression or post-traumatic stress disorder, I don't think it does very well. It may do a little bit better than chance for detecting depression, but not especially well. And I think that using it certainly as a standalone measure is not very good. But even there, some people will say, well, no one uses it as a standalone measure. We only use it in the context of other measures. But even there, it's not clear how much it adds above and beyond better validated measures for detecting depression and PTSD and the like.
Yeah. On Amazon.com, I was able to read through the chapter titles for your book about 50 popular misconceptions in psychology, and it was quite an interesting list. What are your one or two top ones from that list?
Well, that's a top one. Yeah, that was probably the most fun book we wrote. In fact, one of the hardest things was getting it down to 50.
Yeah. Wow.
There's so many of them. Do I have a favorite? I don't know. I think that the ones I get asked about the most are ones that I think are, to a lot of people, really intuitive. So the one I probably get the most email about, questions about, people disagreeing with me about, is the belief that there is what is sometimes called the lunar lunacy effect, that there are more weird, strange things that happen during the full moon. Lots and lots of people insist that that's true, and I've gotten a lot of emails from people who have said something like this: well, I read that chapter in the book, that was interesting, but it's not right, because I'm telling you that there are more weird things that happen during a full moon. I don't believe what the research says. It definitely happens, and I suppose it's possible they're right, and all the studies are wrong, but there have been probably 50 or 60 studies, maybe more now, that have looked at this issue and have found essentially no correlation there to begin with, so there's no correlation to explain, because there's no effect that anyone's been able to statistical effect that no one's been able to define. Is it possible it will be found eventually? It's possible, but at the very least, it's safe to say that if there is a correlation, it must be very, very, very small because no one can seem to detect it. But I think part of the reason we're very prone to that myth, and we point out in the book this is a common source of psychological myths in general, is that we're all prone, myself included, to selective perception. So when there's a full moon and something weird happens, like if someone acts in a fashion that is psychotic, or if there's a crime, or if there's a suicide, or some attention-catching event, people will tend to remember it. They'll say, wow, you know, I remember there was a full moon that night, and there were several murders, or there's a full moon that night, and I saw several people walking the street acting strangely. They'll remember that. Whereas when there's a full moon and nothing happens, people don't pay attention to it. People forget about that. It fades in memory. So as a result, we tend to perceive a correlation that's not there.
Well, I have to wonder how that got into the culture in such an authoritative way. And I would almost claim that I seem to remember reading it in my Intro to Psych book, which would have been like 40 years ago. You know, so it's been a lot of time. Maybe all the research showing that it's not true have happened in the last 40 or 50 years.
Well, I'll tell you, there is an interesting hypothesis, which I may sound a little off the wall, but actually I think it's, I have to confess, when I first heard it, I was a bit dubious, but I read about it and I started to think maybe it's true. There's someone named Chuck Raison. He actually used to be here at Emory. I think he's now in Arizona. And Raison wrote an interesting historical article where he claimed that that correlation may have existed once. Now, it's not causal, but he argues there may have been a correlation once before the advent of natural lighting. So before there was natural lighting, historically he argues that a number of people with bipolar disorder, in particular to some extent epilepsy, and some other conditions, who often have trouble sleeping. So people with bipolar disorders, we know, don't often don't need much sleep, and they're often awake a lot at night. He produces some historical evidence suggesting that a number of individuals with that condition, before there was natural lighting, would often be hanging out at night. And when there's a full moon, of course, it was much brighter. So they would actually often congregate in public places when there was a full moon. And then people might have seen that and then noticed that, well, wait a minute, there's a full moon and people are acting strangely. So it could very well be that at one time there may have been a correlation between these two events.
I would call it, not to dwell too long on this rather minor point, but I seem to recall reading reports that stated that this belief was based on reports by police departments who tracked crime, and that they found that there was more crime rather than individuals' thoughts, that it was based on looking at police records.
Yeah, so, right. So people have actually looked at that, too. There have been some systematic studies that have looked at whether or not there are more crimes, more homicides, and so on during full moons, and those studies have not found that link. Now, it is true that there are some police departments that put more cops on the beat when there's a full moon. So I suspect that you may have what psychologists and epidemiologists call detection bias. If you put more cops around, they're going to start seeing more things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually measure objective crime, there's no difference.
Okay. Well, let's bring this home to clinical psychology. What's been the impact of pseudoscience on clinical psychology? Are there particular negative examples that are persuasive to you?
I think pseudoscience is important for all clinical psychologists to know something about, because I would argue that if we're not careful, some false beliefs can be harmful. So I mentioned recovered memories. Now, there is still some scientific dispute about whether or not certain recovered memories of abuse could be legitimate. And I think it's possible that some might be. I have to confess I'm not convinced of it, but it's possible. Again, it's very hard in science to prove a negative. But what we can be pretty confident about I would argue, extremely confident about is that certain highly suggestive practices, such as leading questions and hypnotizing people and asking them about whether they might have been abused or using guided imagery to get them to think about past abuse and so on, that in highly suggestible individuals, those kinds of practices can lead to false memories of abuse. And I would argue that there are clear-cut cases where that has happened and have really damaged people's lives, both the accuser and the accused. And I think that's been very tragic. I think it's given our field a black eye. And I think, more important, it's also damaged the lives of many, many people, and including those people, by the way, who experience the memories themselves. I realize that's a controversial topic, and one has to deal with it sensitively, but I also think that I think there's now clear-cut evidence that these kinds of practices can happen and do happen, and that they were particularly widespread in the 1990s, although they have not entirely gone away today. There are many other examples in our field where we have engaged in practices that are harmful. Another example is facilitated communication for autism, which, again, I would argue is a case where pseudoscience has gotten us in big trouble for listeners who don't know about it. Facilitated communication was imported from Australia into the United States in the early 1990s at Syracuse University primarily, but then it began to spread. The claim there was that individuals with autism spectrum disorder, as it's now called, in fact are quite capable of communication. They just cannot speak well, most of them, because they have in essence, a movement deficit called developmental dyspraxia, which prevents them from articulating words. It also prevents them from typing independently in many cases. And the claim made is that with the aid of a facilitator who offers a little bit of gentle resistance and support to the child's arm and hands, the child can suddenly type out sentences and words. And when this first appeared in the early 1990s in the United States, people were stunned because it appeared to be the case that children with autism, many of whom had IQs estimated in the 20s or 30s or 40s, were now able to communicate at a level that you and I are able to communicate at, and sometimes even
higher. Yeah, I remember seeing that on 60 Minutes or 2020, one mm-hmm. of those TV magazines, and you know, yep. Wow, this is fantastic. Yep. But later research showed that there was sort of an unconscious physical communication from the person who's holding the arms that's affecting what's being typed.
That's exactly right. So it's colloquially called a Ouija board effect. The technical term is an ideomotor effect. Ideomotor because our ideas can control our movement. It's something that we're all susceptible to, myself included. So, and what's stunning about this is that most of the facilitators, I would suggest the overwhelming majority, were well-intentioned, were sincere, well-meaning people who had no clue, no idea that they, in fact, were the people who were doing, in effect, doing the typing, and not just offering support, but were, in fact, actively guiding the child's hands and fingers to the intended keys. And again, it's an effect a lot of people find difficult to believe, but again, if anyone's done the Ouija board, one can easily see how one's ideas and thoughts can inadvertently affect one's movements and motions. Again, why was this dangerous? Well, it led also to dozens and dozens of accusations of abuse solely based on facilitated communication. That is, the children, adolescents who were engaged in this practice were, in some cases, accusing their parents and other caregivers of brutal sexual and physical abuse. Some individuals were jailed and separated from their families. There was a fairly recent case in the mid-2000s of a family outside of Detroit, the Wendros, you can read about, that was a tragic example of this, where the father and to a lesser extent the mother were put in prison solely on the basis of facilitated accusations of abuse. And even in cases where there was not abuse, this was an intervention that that greatly increased the hopes of many parents and other caregivers, and then tore them down in a way that I think was actually quite cruel. So these are just a couple of examples, I think, of where pseudoscience in psychology can do great harm if we're not careful.
Yes. So it follows, I guess, in a way, that you are a strong proponent for evidence-based psychological treatment. From your point of view, why is that important? Because I know it's been controversial.
Evidence-based treatment is controversial, and I would argue it should not be, although I understand the reasons for it. I think maybe one reason it's controversial is it could be that we haven't always, myself included, articulated clearly enough the rationale for it. I think that, to me, evidence-based practice means practice that is guided on the best available scientific evidence. It doesn't mean it is always right. It doesn't mean it is sacrosanct. It doesn't mean that it will not be overturned eventually. It just means that we have a scientific and ethical obligation to practice on the basis of the best available evidence. And what that means is using research designs that have the best chance of reducing error. And that, I think, is a movement that has been quite well accepted in medicine and dentistry and other fields. And I think it is slowly but surely catching up in psychology, and I think it's beginning to transform practice. Now, there are, I think, a couple of understandable misunderstandings about evidence-based practice. I think one misunderstanding is that somehow we can't innovate or we can't try new things, and I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think that evidence-based practice certainly allows for innovation with new treatments, but I think it also requires us as therapists to make clear when we are trying something new and to give full informed consent and let our clients know when we're doing something that's experimental. And it also forces us, I think, to adopt a burden of proof, which is if we have a client with a particular disorder for which there is an evidence-based treatment, a treatment that's been shown to work fairly well in controlled trials, I think the burden of proof on us is to explain why we're not using it. And there may be cases where we don't use it, and we might want to, in some cases, deviate from the existing protocol. But again, I think the onus of evidence is on us first to show that. I think the other misunderstanding is that evidence-based practice somehow requires us to adopt a cookie-cutter approach to therapy where we have a very strict manual and we can't deviate from it. And I don't think that's typically true. I think most of the manualized treatments out there allow for a certain amount of flexibility, as they should, that there's at least some evidence. I don't think it's overwhelming, but there's some evidence that too rigid an adherence to protocol may be harmful. So we probably want to find a middle ground. We probably want manualized treatments that prescribe a certain general direction of approach and tell us what to do without being overly prescriptive and tell us exactly what to do next and so on. But I think in general, evidence-based practice, although it's not perfect and it's fallible, I think it's our best chance, I think, of reducing error and improving client outcomes. And one big advantage of evidence-based practice, I think, distinguishes it from classically pseudoscientific approaches is that, at least in principle, it is self-correcting. So if it turns out that there are therapies that we didn't think worked but now do work, we can add them to the list. Now, one criticism, and this is a good one, I think, and this is a harder one to answer, is I've been asked this, can I name any treatment that was thought to be evidence-based that's been taken off the list? That's a harder one, right? And that speaks to the difficulty, I think, of finding big differences among different psychological treatments, which is another controversy in and of itself. But it could very well be we're not subjecting these treatments to careful enough scrutiny and maybe allowing too many of them to be called evidence-based.
Well, is there, in fact, a list? You use the word list, and it made me wonder if the APA or some other group has actually created a list of evidence-based
theories. Yeah, there are several different lists out there, so there's a difference. It gets a little subtle here, but evidence-based practice, I would argue, is a general approach to psychotherapy that involves integrating the best available evidence with things like clinical expertise and client preferences. That's the typical way it's operationalized. But there are certainly lists of empirically supported treatments, empirically supported therapies, or ESTs, that basically get at the research aspect of evidence-based practice. So yes, Division 12, the Society for Clinical Psychology of the American Psychological Association, keeps a running list of ESTs, empirically supported therapies, that are part of a general approach to evidence-based practice. And Division 53, I think, I believe that's what it is, child and adolescent, also keeps a list of treatments that have been shown to work pretty well for children and adolescents. So, and those lists are available on the web, and they're continually updated, maybe not as much as they should be, but consumers and therapists can look to those lists to find out what treatments are listed as ESTs. And again, my stance on this, which I've sometimes been criticized for, is that, so I should be clear what I believe and what I don't believe. Sometimes people have accused me of saying, well, if it's not on the list, you can't use it. I don't necessarily believe that. I think there are times and places where, again, you have to deviate from the protocol. But, again, my stance is simply that if you have a clear-cut disorder for which there is a pretty clear-cut EST, empirical support therapy, the default assumption should be that you're going to use that treatment, and that you have an obligation to use that treatment. Again, if there will be going to be cases where the client doesn't respond to that treatment, or the client doesn't want that treatment, and there may be cases where you then have to consider other options. But in general, I think those lists provide helpful guidance to therapists about what kinds of treatments should be first choice options.
Okay. You know, I've interviewed other people around this issue of evidence-based treatments, and some of the points that have come up that have kind of given me pause for thought are that to conduct, say, for example, large sample, double-blind, randomized trials, etc., costs a lot of money. And if somebody, and often that money is going to come from big pharma, because who else has the deep pockets to do that? So unless there's a large kind of political constituency that can help generate funding for that, then those are the ones that are going to be able to rise to that criterion. But that for a sort of smaller, new, innovative approaches, they don't have that money. What are your thoughts around that?
Well, yeah, a couple things. First, a couple of reactions to that. First, I would argue that one could never really do, unfortunately, a true double-blind study of psychotherapy. That's one of the sad truths of our field, right? We can never be truly blind to the therapy we're giving. So that's true. Yeah. So we unfortunately can't have the same model as our colleagues in psychiatry have. I think the big pharma criticism is a potentially valid one, but I don't think it applies to typically psychotherapy trials as much as it does to trials of psychotropics. So I think for medication trials, I think there's some truth to that. I think where there probably is some truth to the criticism is that for to get big money from NIMH, you have to have probably a pretty good track record of previous results. I think it's going to be hard for a research team to get a large pool of money to study a brand new novel form of psychotherapy. I think that's true. But I think what needs to be understood about that is that what the EST list means, and I think this is a common misunderstanding, is merely that the treatments on the list have been empirically supported. It does not mean that the treatments that are not on the list are invalidated. Merely means they are unvalidated. There's a big difference. It's only one letter. But an invalidated treatment is one that has been looked at, has been studied, has been shown not to work. there are lots and lots of other treatments out there that are promising and are interesting and worth looking at in research that are still unvalidated, that are not on the list. And it's very important for us to make clear, I think maybe we haven't always made as clear as we could or should, that merely because a treatment is not on the list doesn't mean it doesn't work, doesn't mean it might not work really well, doesn't mean it might not work better than the existing treatments. All it means is that it has not yet been subjected to sufficient empirical scrutiny. Does that mean that people who are proponents of some of these treatments may have to wait longer than they'd like to get on the list? Yes, but that's true in all areas of treatment, certainly true in medicine as well. And again, the key thing is for people to understand that a treatment may be very, very promising and not on the list, and that's certainly true. But because the treatment hasn't been adequately studied yet, we can't yet say it's empirically supported.
Are there treatments out there right now that you consider to be based on pseudoscience?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Are there some that you'd be willing to name?
Sure. The ones I mentioned, I think recovered memory therapies are an example of that, especially highly suggestive techniques. I think facilitated communication is an example of that. I think I would put energy therapies in that camp, although I don't know of any evidence that they are dangerous. I would put them, many of them, as classically pseudoscientific, with the caveat that I regard pseudoscience as less applicable to the technique itself and more the claims that are made about it. To me, pseudoscience doesn't necessarily apply to a method itself as much as a set of claims surrounding that method, but that's maybe a technicality that we don't need to get into. But I think that the energy therapy movement I would describe largely as pseudoscientific, because I think the claims that are made that these therapies work by manipulating invisible energy fields, I don't think are grounded in established principles. I think the claims go well ahead of the data. I think they make claims and promises that I think are not well supported.
So these would be tapping therapies.
I would put those in the same same category. Again, I think I don't know of any persuasive evidence that those techniques are harmful. I also don't know of any persuasive evidence that they work any better than the placebo effect or other kinds of nonspecific effects.
Now, speaking of the placebo effect, and I know in drug research, the placebo effect is kind of something you're trying to get rid of, to really figure out what's causal. But what are your thoughts about the placebo effect in relation to psychotherapy?
That's a good one, and that's a very fraught issue. It's a very complex issue in psychotherapy theory and psychotherapy research, and it's a really, really difficult one to address, in part because I think, as you correctly point out, part of what makes psychotherapy works is the promise of getting better. Part of what makes psychotherapy work is combating demoralization, and in part what we call the placebo effect, and we regard it as an artifact, I think. Part of what we call the placebo effect may actually be part of the effective ingredients of psychotherapy.
Yeah,
so I think one has to be clear.
One has
to be very clear when one's talking about the placebo effect. From a research, this is where maybe people get confused about it and where I sometimes find it a bit perplexing too, is that from a research standpoint, it is an artifact, right? If you're trying to figure out whether or not a therapy works better than the mere expectation of improvement, then the placebo effect is something you want to minimize or get rid of to draw a clear inference about whether your therapy does better than an intervention that merely engenders expectations of hope and improvement. However, that's very different from a therapeutic context. In a therapeutic context, it's not at all clear that you want to get rid of a placebo effect, because after all, part of what makes therapy work is the expectation of getting better, and part of what we call the placebo effect almost certainly involves common factors across therapies that we in fact know work, like the power of the therapeutic alliance and empathy and rapport and problem solving and goal building and all these kinds of things. So
and maybe things like degrees hanging on the wall and you know, and other sorts of very non-specific things that, you know, it actually might be desirable in some ways to enhance.
Well, that's right. And Jerome Frank wrote about this in the 60s, and he was right. And that's right. Degree hanging on a wall is not a particularly specific effect of psychotherapy, but it does, after all, instill a certain amount of confidence. When I go into a physician's office and I see a diploma hanging on the wall, that makes me feel, at least to some degree, maybe this person knows what they're talking about, at least they have some level of adequate training. And although that may not be particularly theoretically interesting, it probably is part and parcel of at least one important ingredient in what makes people get better, which is the belief that they can get better.
I'm wondering if your critical thinking around these issues has brought you into forensic work as an expert witness.
I've only done a little bit of expert witness work. I've only done one case, actually, when I've been on the stand. I've done consulting with attorneys, but I haven't done that much expert witness work, although I get called a lot to do it. Mm-hmm. But I'm often a bit reluctant to do it because I sometimes feel that we're, as a field, a little too likely to do expert witness work, and so I'm the only time I've agreed to.
It seems like sometimes psychology is called upon to make judgments about things that we're not really, that are maybe not really within our expertise.
Well, that's exactly my feeling, and so that may be an account for some of my reluctance. But I have done it once, and I've consulted on a few cases involving recovered memories, and I did do one case that involved hypnotically refreshed testimony where someone was put in prison because of rape on the basis of hypnotically refreshed testimony, where the person was hypnotized and asked to remember what a rapist looked like after initially saying that she could not remember what he looked like. So basically she, without going into detail, was a case in New Jersey. It was a case in which the all she could say is that, I mean, she clearly was raped, and she was raped very late at night when there was very little light, ambient light in the room. And all she could say is, I remember he was black, or he was African-American, and he was wearing a dark jacket. That's all I remember, because he told me that if I looked at him, he'd kill me. So she was raped. Luckily, he didn't stab her, and he left. And she told the police, "I can't remember what the guy looks like, other than the fact he's African American and a bulky guy, and blah blah." And then they brought in a hypnotist to refresh her memory. And then after that, after quite a bit of pressing, she then claimed to remember something of what he looked like, and then they found somebody who looked a little bit like this guy and arrested him and put him in prison, more or less solely on the basis of that testimony. I found that case to be profoundly egregious, and I thought it was a terrible miscarriage of justice and a terrible miscarriage of science, in part because the hypnotist actually stated in his during the session that memory works like a video camera, a tape recorder, and I want you to rewind the tape to the beginning of the rape and move it forward. And then he would actually ask her to mentally pause the tape and then rewind it and so on. It was just, it was a terrible example of, in my view, of how not to do therapy, even though he's not doing therapy per se, but it certainly bears on psychotherapy, and then a terrible example of how not to interrogate victims of crimes.
Yeah. Now, I'm intrigued by your book, Brainwashed, The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience. And I guess, in large part, my interest is, trigger both as a, from a psychological point of view, but I also do work as a market research consultant. Mm-hmm. And there's been a big swing in that arena of marketing and market research, with claims that people can detect, you know, what brands are going to, or what advertising, et cetera, mm-hmm. is going to have an impact in buyer choices. And I think that's really overreaching, but people have really glommed onto that.
Yeah, that one of the chapters in our book is actually on neuromarketing, and you're exactly right. That's become a big trend, and a lot of advertising agencies are, especially in this very, very competitive world out there, are trying to get any edge they can over other advertising agencies and trying to find some way of peering directly into the brains of people to find out what products they prefer. So that's right. There are a number of companies now that are sticking people's heads into functional magnetic resonance imaging machines and trying to see what kind of products they like, see what kind of commercials excite them, and turn on their brains, ventral striatum is the most, the reward centers and so on. And is it pseudoscience? I guess it depends on the nature of the claims being made. But I will say this, a lot of these companies, maybe not all, but a lot of them are making claims that go way, way ahead of the data. And in particular, what's missing from much of the neuromarketing field, I think there's now a little bit of research, including some being done by my Emory colleague Greg Burns, that may suggest a little bit of promise for this. I'm not close to neuromarketing, but up until recently, there had been very few studies showing that brain images contribute to predicting what products people will buy above and beyond merely asking them. That's the first thing you want to do is ask them, if you see these two products, which do you like better, which you're more likely to buy? And sure enough, if you look at people's brain scans, you find that in general, what they say they like corresponds to which ones seem to activate their brain's reward centers a bit more. So the question is, do the brain scans actually buy you, no pun intended, additional information above and beyond merely asking people? And there's a little bit of suggestion that might be the case in some cases, but we don't yet know. And that's really the major task of neuromarketers, is to show that they give us added value, that the brain scans tell us something we couldn't already tell. And I think oftentimes that's a broader problem with a lot of neuroscience, is that a lot of the claims being made from neuroimaging studies, not all, and again, I think neuroimaging has a tremendous amount of potential, but unless we're careful, there's always a danger that we can make claims that we've learned something new from neuroimages, when in fact we could glean that information much more simply, much more parsimoniously from merely giving people questionnaires or asking them.
Okay, I know you're short on time, so let me squeeze in just one more question here.
Sure.
What's your impression of the impact of neuroscience on talk psychotherapies?
Neuroscience and psychotherapy. So I'm mixed about it. I think that I suspect that neuroscience has some things to offer psychotherapy. I think that it may one day inform psychotherapeutic approaches. But I think the problem is that right now there are too many levels of analysis to cross. So we've got the brain level of analysis, we have the functional level, and then we have lots of other levels in between. We have the levels of thoughts and emotions and personality traits, and then we have social factors and cultural factors and so on. And for the brain to inform the psychological level of analysis, we have to get at what Freud called the in-between. There's a huge logical, conceptual gap between what we know about the brain and what we know about thoughts, feelings, personality traits, and so on. We don't know how to bridge that gap yet. And I think people who claim that we do are running way ahead of the data.
I think some of the therapists I've spoken to say that by talking about the brain with their clients, kind of positioning their issues in terms of what they call brain talk, that the clients seem to feel relieved, I guess, of any guilt that they might have about their condition. And, oh, I see, okay, so it fits really within a scientific framework, and that somehow that facilitates the process of therapy.
Yeah, and I don't have any problem with that. I think that kind of psychoeducation, I suspect, I don't have any data that it's helpful, but I wouldn't be surprised if in some cases it helps people to better understand the nature of their problem. Maybe it reduces self-stigma, maybe it reduces blame. I don't have any problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
Although I also think that it's important not to just focus on the brain level of analysis. I think you also want to focus on how psychotherapies change emotions and thinking patterns and so on. I think talking about how they're instantiated in the brain is just fine, and I suspect may be helpful and may lead people to be more accepting of therapies. So I don't have any problem with that. But I think the broader issue is, can neuroscience directly inform the design and implementation of specific therapies? I don't think we yet know how to do that. I think there's some potential, and my Emory colleague Helen Mayberg has shown this, that maybe brain imaging can help us to predict what kinds of clients are most responsive to certain kinds of therapy. So she has shown, for example, that there are certain brain imaging differences, particularly in the insula, which is an area that's often involved in certain negative emotions like disgust and so on. She has shown, along with some of my other Emory colleagues, that there are certain brain patterns that seem to predict response to cognitive behavioral therapy, certain other brain patterns, especially in the insula, that seem to predict better who's going to respond to antidepressant medication. That work has not yet been replicated, but I think that's very interesting and very promising, and it could very well be that in a decade we will be doing more of that, matching patients to treatments, for example, either different kinds of psychological treatments or psychological treatments versus biological treatments on the basis of their brain imaging patterns. I think it's possible, but again, I think one thing we've learned in this field is that oftentimes, certain exciting developments don't pan out the way we wanted or take a lot longer to implement than we'd hoped. So I think that work is fascinating. I think it has a lot of potential. But again, I think we're not yet ready to say we can do that and match people to treatments simply on the basis of their brain imaging patterns.
Okay. Well, you've been very generous with your time. So Dr. Scott Lilienfeld, I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been my pleasure.
I was glad to discover that Dr. Scott Lilienfeld is not nearly so absolutist as the titles of his books might suggest. There were a number of questions that I'd planned for him that there wasn't time to get to. However, given his answers to the questions that I did get to, I think I understand his position well enough to take an educated guess as to how he might have responded to some of them. For example, I had planned to ask him whether or not he sees science as the only legitimate way of knowing. I don't think he would have given an unqualified yes to that question. However, had he done so, I would have asked about other sources of knowledge, such as naturalistic observation, the role of intuition, and in terms of psychotherapy, the role of the client's inner world / subjective knowing. Like Dr. Lilienfeld, I consider myself a strong proponent of science, but it should also be clear that I don't think it's the only way of knowing. I had also planned to ask him about his views on complementary alternative medicine, or CAM, C-A-M. I'm sure he would have given a balanced response to that question, and at the same time, he might have demurred from speaking about medicine per se, noting that it would be outside his competence. I had also planned to ask him if he is categorically against all novel, unsupported therapies. This would have been a softball question, inasmuch as I was able to read on Amazon.com passages from one of his books in which he makes it clear that he is not against all unsupported therapies. As we heard in the interview, he clearly believes that new ideas and new approaches should have the opportunity to see the light of day, but then he would hope that the proponents of those would go the next step and see what evidence they could marshal to support those new ideas and approaches. I would have liked to have asked about his attitude toward current psychodynamic approaches to psychotherapy. I'm not sure what his response to that would be. I thought I saw some negative stuff when I was searching around on Amazon, but I didn't get enough context to be certain about his attitude. Had he claimed that there is a lack of empirical support for these approaches, I would have referred him to the Jonathan Shedler article that appeared in The American Psychologist, and also my own interview with Dr. Shedler on Shrink Wrap Radio, episode number 236, on the efficacy of psychodynamic therapies. where I thought he made a very strong case for empirical support. By the way, I should mention that Dr. Lilienfeld is also trained as a clinical psychologist, and I didn't get around to asking if he currently does psychotherapy, and if so, what evidence-based approaches he uses. So I think I went into the interview maybe with a little bit of a chip on my shoulder, feeling somewhat defensive about some of my own favorite therapies and some of the guests and approaches that I brought onto Shrink Wrap Radio. Indeed, it's just that sort of resistance that he's met with from a wide variety of therapists. As he notes, there's long been a gap between science and practitioners. I think most people agree that doing whatever is reasonably possible and legitimate to narrow that gap makes sense. At the end of the day, I think he raises legitimate concerns that we can all learn from, and I find myself largely in agreement. If you would like to purchase any of the books that we discussed in this interview, I hope you'll remember to use our Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on the shrinkwrapradio.com website.
Hey, Dr. Dave. My name is Carl, and I just wanted to call and take a minute to say thanks so much for the podcast. You do a great job, and I've probably been listening for about the last 5 years during my time in graduate school in Seattle and up to the present. Your shows have inspired me. They've been illuminating, entertaining, educational, so I really appreciate them. I'm a Jungian-leaning psychoanalytically trained therapist, and I've really enjoyed your guests over the years, some that come to mind, Nancy McWilliams, David Wallen, Raul Moncayo, and recently Donald Kalshid, as well as many others. I've done my best to be an evangelist for the show, I've shared it a lot with my colleagues and friends, and I will continue to do so. I'm also happy to say that I've finally gotten around to becoming a financial contributor and plan on continuing to do that because the podcast has really helped me both as a therapist and just as a person. I think the show is great, especially, for us Jungians, but even before I was into the world of Jung, I enjoyed the show. I thought about writing you an email, but realized that you might enjoy it more hearing somebody's voice. And I think my reason for writing the email was just so that I could get something back. But then I thought, I've gotten plenty from you and hope you just enjoy hearing another human's voice who really appreciates the podcast and want to encourage you to keep up the good work. Thanks a lot, Dr. Dave. Take care.
Thank you, Carl. I hope others will be inspired by your example. Unfortunately, there are no new donors since the last podcast episode to add to our honor roll. How about getting your name up there? Carl also suggested a guest for me to interview, Dr. Neville Symington, who is a British psychoanalyst. So if you're listening to this, Carl, be assured I got your request and have added it to my long and growing list. As you heard me mention, one of the books Dr. Lilienfeld co-authored is titled Brainwashed, The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience. And as you heard us discuss, it's about the way that many people are overreaching on the claims they make for neuroscience. That makes this a very important book for any of you who are interested in the brain and neuroscience. Audible.com has it in their catalog, and it will provide about 6 hours of education and entertainment. Well, if you are not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can use our special discount link and download it for absolutely free, yours to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription, by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. Or you can get any one of their other 165,000 titles, many of which are also about psychology. Has anybody used our iTunes affiliate link in the left-hand sidebar to purchase a song, album, iBook, or app? I'm hoping somebody will buy something because I don't see any activity there when I check in. I'm concerned that it may not be working, so if you buy something there, even a 99-cent song or whatever, please drop me a line and let me know. I really need to be assured that it is working. Finally, you know there is an Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar, and do you know you can also use that to order not just books, but anything at Amazon? I know many of you probably use Amazon regularly to purchase all sorts of things. Plus, the season of giving is upon us, and many of you will probably purchase some of those gifts on Amazon. If you'll use the search tool in our widget on the right-hand sidebar, it will automatically add our affiliate code, and shrink wrap will get a small percentage of the purchase. So it's just another way that you can help to support us. And I will thank you.
This is Gloria Ullman from Adelaide in South Australia, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave, along with thousands of other listeners who have all been shrink wrapped to fit on it.
Thank you, Gloria Ullman, longtime supporter and champion transcriber. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag, and I'll read just a couple. First, we hear from Andrea, who writes, "Good afternoon, Dr. Dave. I just listened to the podcast about insomnia and sleep apnea. I found it very interesting. My husband actually uses a CPAP and found his sleep much improved. Also, my brother happens to work for Apple. You mentioned that you were interested in a tracking device that would work with your iPhone. Right now, I can tell you that the Fitbit does a pretty good job of tracking your sleep. It functions primarily as a movement detector. When coupled with the Fitbit app, it tracks the number of steps you take during the day and has a sleep mode where it tracks how much you moved around at night. You can look at the app to view a sleep chart. On the chart, there is a timeline. Each time you are restless, a green line appears on the chart. Each time you wake up, a red line appears on the chart. It also shows an approximation of how many hours you slept versus how many minutes, hours you were awake at night. From my experience, it appears to be fairly accurate. Soon, Apple will be releasing the Apple Watch. I believe this device will track steps, heart rate, sleep, and even a few other metrics not covered by the Fitbit. It will also sync with your iPhone." And then she says, "For more info," and she gives me a link to Apple, and I'm sure you can find that on your own if you're interested. She also goes on to say there are also non-Apple sleep monitor devices. They may or may not work as well. I do not know too much about them. I hope this information is helpful. Thank you for a fantastic program. And that's from Andrea, who is a registered nurse. And I did get back to Andrea to let her know that actually I have a Fitbit, but it's one of the older models that I clip onto my pocket, and it is great for tracking the steps that I take when I go on my walks. However, the model that she's talking about is a bracelet that you wear around your wrist, and you need that model in order to track your sleep. And so I don't know if I'm sufficiently motivated to go out and buy another Fitbit at this point, but it's something for me to think about. Okay, here's another one, a short one from Veronica, who writes, "Hi, Dr. David. Just to let you know that the card that I use on PayPal has expired, and because of that, I couldn't pay my contribution. I already asked my bank to send me another card. It will take a little while because I live in Spain, but my bank is in Brazil. But as soon as I have it, I will go back to contributing to one of my favorite podcasts of all times ever. Lots of love," and that's from Veronica. And I really appreciate that email from Veronica. Maybe it's because year is changing or because of all the hacking of various corporate sites, but it seems like a lot of people have been discontinued on PayPal, a number of people, who've not contacted me in the way that Veronica has, and I wish they would. So if you're one of those people, let me know what's going on, and please resubscribe to continue your support. For this past week or two, actually, I've lost more people than I've gained. So I hope that's not a trend. So with that, I think I better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014, which actually is how Carl was able to send that note about his encouragement to donate to Shrink Wrap Radio. Thanks to Scott Lilienfeld for alerting us to the dangers and misinformation lurking in pseudoscience. My next episode will feature return guest, New York Times journalist Clive Thompson, who I interviewed on episode number 387, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. And this time we'll be speaking about his recent article, Can Video Games Fend Off Mental Decline?, which appeared in the October 23rd, 2014 issue of the New York Times Magazine. He's one of my favorite guests, so I hope you'll join us. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.